Accession number 24610, Wheel 10.
Mr. Guest, Real 10. We got to a point where in October 1952 you'd been taken to a work camp, I think it was going to be.
Yeah, it was going to be, yeah.
A Pyoktong.
No. it was on the way to Pyoktong. We were there for a couple of nights on the journey.
Sorry, the temple was on the way to Pyoktong?
No, the temple was in Pyoktong, but the work camp was just some wooden huts. I'm not sure whether they called it the mining camp or not. But anyway, that was the general format. And we only stayed there a couple of nights, Chikin and I. We made sort of friends with the chaps there. I met George Empson there, who I'd previously had contact with in the early part of my capture. And we renewed our acquaintance. And then, as I say, after a couple of days, Chikin and I were moved on the back of a truck. I'm not quite sure how long we travelled, whether we stayed, whether we had an overnight stop or not. But eventually we arrived at the reservoir, which is by the side of Pyoktong, and we were taken across the water on an oar-driven ferry. This was a raft of logs lashed together with some sort of a hull beneath it. I'm not quite sure because I was laying flat on my back. And this was paddled across to the other side of the river, and we were unloaded, taken into a little hutted encampment, which was occupied by the Chinese. We were given some noodle soup, and then they proceeded to take us up the hill to the temple. I was in the temple for two or three days, and then they decided to cut my plaster off, and things started to seem a bit better. And after a period of time, my legs started to swell up, and I developed a sinus from the wound, which was suppurating, and it was diagnosed that I'd got osteomyelitis again. The doctor there was quite a friendly man, although a little bit guarded. He obviously was very much into communist China. He was full of the red flag and Chairman Mao and one thing or another, but he treated us fairly kindly, and he spoke quite good English. He'd actually, I don't know if he actually flew, but he served with the Flying Tigers against the Japanese in the Sino-Japanese War. Presumably he was with the Chiang Kai-shek regime, and he learnt English from the Americans and various nationalities that flew these Flying Tiger aeroplanes. He administered our everyday medication. And then one day I was taken down the hillside. We had another doctor that came in, and he actually probed the sinus on my leg to see how deep it was. And in fact, the sinus was so long that he pushed it through to the other side, there being obviously being a gap in the femur somewhere. Although it was joining together, but there was obviously a gap through it. And he pushed this probe right through my leg, and there was a quick consultation with Dr. Yeh, and a couple of days later I was taken down the hillside into a headmaster's room, I think, of a school at the bottom of the hill, and I was laid on a table. Another spinal anaesthetic was administered, and this young surgeon proceeded to trim the bone again and take out the odd bits of bone and rubbish that were still in my leg. I was taken back to the hut, and my leg was propped up on a couple of rice sacks filled with chaff or something to elevate the leg to stop the bleeding, and I spent an uncomfortable couple of days with my leg propped up in the air. Anyway, my leg gradually healed, and I was able to get out of bed and sit up, and gradually I learnt to walk on crutches and get about and get to know the other people. We had an American guy from Boston named George. I can't remember his surname, but George used to do the cooking for us. The food was a lot better here. We used to get potatoes in with our vegetables, which was a welcome change, and occasionally we'd get a fried egg, usually the Chinese mixed egg with soup, but George used to get a ration of eggs, and I don't know how many there were of us, but probably about 12, 14, 16 perhaps in this temple, and George would prepare the morning meal, which was usually a vegetable type soup with some rice, and then he used to have a ladle, and he would fry these eggs singly in the ladle and lay them over the top of your soup bowl. This was a welcome change to our diet. As I say, I started getting about on these crutches, and by this time we're getting into late November, early December, and I put a lot of practice in, and we had a few books to read, most of them Russian type books. I remember one I read, the story of a real man about a Russian who had both legs amputated. It was quite a good story really, but having nothing else to read, you know, it was something to do.
How were your other wounds? But you know, you had a lot of wounds.
Well, I did, yeah. Actually, when shortly after I got captured, I did count up the wounds that were being treated, although some of them were only, shall we say, elastoplast type wounds, but I'd actually been punctured about 32 times. I had a piece of shrapnel through my left ear. I had a slit across the front of my nose. I had a hole in my cheek where either a bullet or a piece of shrapnel had gone through. I'd also had a bullet wound near the shoulder of my right arm. It entered just below the armpit in the front and went right through my body and exited just over my shoulder blade.
You mentioned that one, yeah.
And it missed all the bones anyway. And this was a bit of trouble for a while, but it healed up fairly well and wasn't too much bother. And I've not had any trouble with it since.
So it's only really the leg.
The leg was the prime problem. Yeah.
So what happened next then? You were in this camp near Pyeongtaek.
Yeah, in this hospital in Pyeongtaek. And then we came up to Christmas, and I remember gradually using my crutches less and less, and I managed to walk round the building on New Year's Eve. On Christmas Eve, without my crutches. That was the first time I'd really walked unaided since the 28th of May. The temple was a typical Buddhist temple, set on, I think, on six steps, and then a typical sort of Chinese or Japanese or anyway Eastern building with the extended eaves and sliding or swinging doors with lattice type doors with rice paper on them on the front. Seemingly the six steps up to the entrance were the six steps towards heaven, and the seventh step, which was not existent there, was the final step into heaven. Anyway, we were there for Christmas. We had a bit of a treat at Christmas. The Chinese pulled the stops out, shall I say. We got some paper and decorated the room up a bit. I remember cutting out some letters, Merry Christmas. A bit ironic, really, considering we were prisoners of war, but you had to make most of your situation. We had quite a nice meal that day. Soup and rice from one thing and another, and the Chinese cook who cooked for the staff, he came up trumps and he sent in a bowl of lion's heads, which were a small Chinese cabbage with the center taken out, and the cup of the cabbage, as it were, stuffed with pork and bread, and the leaves folded over, tied with a string, and these were stewed in a pot for about 24 hours, and they were really delicious. One of the finest meals I think I'd had whilst I was a prisoner of war. Anyway, on the 6th of January, I had my 22nd birthday, and shortly after that, we were moved off by truck, a group of us. We'd had a contingent of Americans that came into the hospital to have their wounds treated. Whilst we were there, just after Christmas, we had we were passed through a truck with a fluoroscope in it, which took X-rays of our anatomy. I stood there, and the doctor looked through the screen and studied my leg. And shortly after that, we moved out to a POW camp in a village called Son Sedong.
Before we go on to that, there's just a couple of more points. What about this? You sent a message home. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, just before Christmas, the Chinese approached me and said that they were going to make wire recordings and broadcast messages from prisoners, and would I consider making a message to my folks at home? And I sort of had misgivings about this. I didn't want to be part of any propaganda scheme, which was obviously what it was. But in the same token, I knew that my parents and my loved ones, they didn't know that I was alive. I'd written letters, and I never got any back, so I assumed that the letters were never sent by the Chinese. These were just taken for, shall we say, information purposes. Anyway, I mulled this over in my mind. About making this, shall we say, propaganda message. And I thought, well, what the hell, if there's any repercussions, then I will excuse myself at a later date. And I did actually make a message home and tell them that I was in good health and I was getting on okay and looking forward to the time that I would come home. And apparently...
Did you have to say anything that they might have wanted
No, they never prompted me at all, but it was expected of you to say, you know, you're in good health and good health, good hands. We're getting us, you know, we're treated well, and we're getting supplies of soap and toothpaste and tobacco,
which was pretty well true.
I mean, there was never any physical ill treatment. There was always that feeling of mental anguish, you know. One was always on one's guard against the Chinese, and we had to be very careful how we expressed ourselves, otherwise they would get upset. But in the main, we were left pretty much to ourselves, and we were treated reasonably well. Although, as I said, that the medical treatment was crude, it was aggressive, but it was effective.
Well, that's also just the way their medical treatment was.
I think that they were treating us the same way as they treated their own soldiers.
Now, what about the cold? Because this is December.
This is December. When I started walking, there was actually snow on the ground, and after a few experimental walks around the building, I thought it better to keep inside, and we had very cold nights and quite deep snow. I think the building was heated. Although not terribly much, because we kept our cotton padded clothes on during the day. I think there was a certain amount of heat that came from the kitchen that George worked in. There were voids under the floor, and the heat from the fire warmed the floor up a bit. Although it was quite a tall building inside, and so the temperature was not much above what it was outside. Although, as I say, we kept our cotton padded clothes on, and we had two or three blankets on the bed, and we managed to keep reasonably warm. The only times I remember being cold is when we walked out to the toilets at the back of the hospital building, which were hole in the ground sort of thing, with a few rice sacks round to keep the Arctic wind off. And one had to be very quick about one's bodily functions, because it was so bloody cold it would nip you. I recall walking back from there one day, and we had, we had these cotton padded uniforms on. A typical cotton padded hat, which used to be like the old leather helmet the pilots used to wear, with a visor on and ear pads, and we also had cotton padded gloves. I remember walking back from the toilet one morning. It was very cold, and I mounted the bottom step, and on my way up the steps, I just slipped one of my gloves off to open the door. And just as a matter of course, I blew in my hand. And I put it on the door ring. And I suppose the resultant moisture on my hand and the coldness of the handle. My hand stuck to the handle. And because I pulled my hand off. And it left a frost burn on my hand. And little tiny bits of skin were actually torn off and were left on the handle. So in future times, we used to keep our gloves on before we touched any cold metal. It was that cold. I know shortly after Christmas, funnily enough, at Christmas time, we did have a part of a pig in with our food. And we actually watched them on Christmas morning half a dozen Chinese, one at the front with a big knife, chasing this pig to try and corner it, to slaughter it. And it was like the Keystone Cops. They'd get the pig in the corner, and the man with the knife would thrust himself forward, and the pig would break free and dash off between the legs, and then it would start all over again. And it was quite funny, really, although it wasn't funny for the poor old pig. Anyway, I think this happened about sort of 10 o'clock in the morning, and we had portions of this pig about 6 o'clock at night. So that was fresh meat.
Now, you mentioned, I think that you moved to this POW camp, number 3 annex at Sonsadong.
Yeah, Sonsadong, yeah.
Now, what do you remember of your time? How far away was that from the other place? Had you gone far?
It wasn't very far, no. I've seen it on the map since, although, I mean, the roads there were quite torturous. They followed the line of the hills, gradually rising and falling as the valleys and the passes developed, and I think it was a good day before we actually arrived in this camp.
Now, what was this camp? Can you describe the layout of this
camp? Yeah, the camp was one half of a one street village. Typical village in Korea. There was a road, dirt road, went through it, and houses built either side. A few further back, but in the main, the most important houses were on this road. And we had one half of the village, and the Koreans lived in the other half. The demarcation point seemed to be the well where we used to draw our water. We would assemble at the well in dribs and drabs. The Koreans would be there collecting water also, but we didn't have anything to do with them. We were more or less expected to keep ourselves apart from the villagers. In fact, one of the POWs. We called him Bird. His name was James Oliver, and we used to do a muster parade in the morning, counting heads and one thing and another, make sure nobody had gone away, because there was no barbed wire or entanglements or anything around the village. But really, when looked at in the cold light of day, if any one of us would have escaped, where would they have gone? And the terrain was extremely unfriendly. There were no arterial roads or anything like this. They were just tracks, which could lead anywhere. And with the fact that we'd been moved back from, shall we say, halfway up Korea, and multi-directional travel, we hadn't got a clue where we were. In fact, I've found out since that Sonsadong was not too far from Pyoktong, and not too far from the Yalu River. But with the roads winding in and out of the hills, we'd got no idea where we were, really. There was one guy in the camp. Now, I think there was about 218 of us, if I remember rightly. One guy in the camp named Studenmeyer. He was part of an air crew that was hit over Mig Alley. Because the Yalu was nicknamed Mig Alley, where the American Lightnings and the Russian-built MIGs used to have dogfights fairly regular. He bailed out over Mig Alley and finished up in our camp. I think the commander of his plane was taken elsewhere, and I suppose he of all people would have some idea of where we were geographically. But I would have thought it would have been very difficult for him to find his way back out into freedom.
Now, what were the billets like? You know, you were in the houses,
don't you? We were billeted in houses. These were typical Korean houses. You got a two-roomed, low two-room building with a little a dugout and roofed kitchen lean-to on the end. These would contain two or three cooking pots. The fire was built underneath them, and as in other dwellings, the heat of the fire would obviously cook the food in the pots, and the residual heat would meander under the floor and out of the chimney at the far end. So there was a certain amount of underfloor heating, like the old Roman type of construction. There would be about eight people to the room, and the room would be, I suppose, about 10 foot by 8 foot, and just over 6 foot to the ceiling. They were built in wattle and daub, mud plaster, on wattle sticks, which were attached to a stronger frame, and then as typical Korean house, with a veranda or an overhang of the roof before it got to the vertical tree trunks, which you know kept you in the dry pretty well up through the village. We had a library, and that was in a two-story building with a very narrow flight of stairs, quite crude stairs, but they managed to get you into the upstairs rooms. And I got the feeling that the house, before it was taken over as a prisoner of war dwelling, it might have belonged to some dignitary in the village itself. But as I say, that we were segregated from the villagers. I did mention James Oliver, and I don't know if I quite finished my story about him.
I don't think
him.
You did, no. Tell us that.
He was late for muster parade one morning, and he came dashing out of the hut, and he bumped into a Korean woman, and of course she kicked up a hell of a fuss because he dumped her on her backside, and he picked her up, and this caused even more consternation, and the Chinese actually put him in solitary confinement for 2 weeks for attempted rape. I mean, this was absolutely ludicrous, but and whether they were actually serious in what they were saying, but Jim spent 2 weeks in solitary confinement.
Did you tell us about some of the people you were staying with? Because George Empson was there.
Yeah, I renewed my acquaintanceship with George Empson. I was walking pretty well by this time, although my leg was stiff, but I was getting around fairly well. And George was in a hut, or two or three houses up the road from us. I met some people out of the Gloucesters.
What was George like? I mean, can you tell us a bit about George?
George was a carpenter by trade. He came from Hull. He was just an ordinary type of guy. He'd got a pretty good sense of humour, and we used to spend a bit of time together smoking our cigarettes, playing cards. Nearly every hut, or I should say every hut, had a pack of cards, or perhaps two pack of cards, depending on how many rooms there were. We were issued with a couple of blankets, and we used to sleep on the floor, on the rice matting, which was on top of an earth floor.
Was that warm with you?
It was not too bad, yeah, because we used to keep a little fire going most of the time, and it used to took the chill off the air. I was actually still with Peter Booth. Peter got sent back with us to this Camp 3, and Peter and I used to sleep fairly close together. And we'd got cotton padded cotton uniforms, which were really like cotton pajamas, and we used to use these at night and sleep in our under our blankets, and put our cotton padded clothes over the top of us.